On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hollywood's America is no stranger to angry men in big, violent worlds, solitary anti-heroes fighting fire with fire while life rolls on for us, mere mortals. Trace that theme back and you come to two giants of the Western, director John Ford and actor John Wayne. In 1956, at the height of Cold War and race tension, they brought out the raw, racially charged Western classic, The Searchers. John Wayne as rage-filled obsessive, tracking down a kidnapped girl, the flawed, savage hero, defending civilization against savagery. Many film critics put it among the top five films of all time, and it resonates large today. Up next on Point, New York Times film critic A.O. Scott on John Wayne, John Ford, and The Searchers. Joining me now from New York, A.O. Scott, celebrated film critic for the New York Times. He's written recently about The Searchers, out in a new 50th anniversary DVD from Warner Home Video. A.O. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Very nice to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Scott.
A.O. Scott, take us into this story. It's got the famous opening, the cabin door, the dark interior of the cabin out in the Texas frontier opens, and we see, in fact, not Texas, 1868, but Monument Valley, John Ford's beloved sort of epic scenery of the West. The coziness of the dark home opening up to this huge, uncaring, almost savage landscape, and an incredible story unfolds. Give us a sense of this, the heart of this story.
Well, the heart of the story, I think, is the character Ethan Edwards, played by John Wayne. Really one of his great performances, one of his most complicated performances, the kind of role where you see something different in the character, I think, every time you see the movie. And he comes home. He's been wandering. He's an ex-Confederate soldier. He doesn't really say where he's been in the 3 years since the war ended.
Up to no good, we're led to believe.
Right. And someone says at one point, you know, I heard you were in California. And he says, well, I sure as heck wasn't in California. But that's all he says. And he has he's a sort of solitary figure. He comes to this home of his brother and sister-in-law and his beloved nieces. And it seems to kind of to settle back into some kind of normal domestic life, mm-hmm. the kind of thing that he probably hasn't had very much of in a very long time and that he might not be very well suited for. And there's a Comanche raid. The homestead is burned. The daughters are kidnapped, and he sets out to find them, and it becomes this obsessive search that occupies him over years, and that reveals these sides of his character, this obsessive hatred of the Indians and the Comanches that also it relies on and is expressed through a very intimate knowledge of their culture and their ways, and it kind of goes on episodically until finally he discovers the older niece. Debbie, who's grown into Natalie Wood, mm-hmm. Who it turns out he's planning not to rescue but to kill because she's come of age and presumably she's been, you know, dishonored, raped by the Indians and become one of them. And so to defend the honor of family and race, he decides to kill her and at the last moment relents and brings her home. And the last shot of the movie evokes the first one. He's standing outside the door of the homestead. Everyone is rushing in, and he can't come in. He's the person who will go to any length to defend what he sees as the values of this frontier society. But precisely because of that, because of his rage and his violence and the kind of character he is, he can't join into it, and he sort of wanders off at the end, who knows toward where.
Let's hear that voice of John Wayne. The rage starts early in The Searchers. Here he is on the trail of his nieces with his brother's adopted son, Martin Pauley, played by Jeffrey Hunter, who's part Cherokee, and they come across a dead Comanche. The search party finds buried on the trail. John Wayne shoots the eyes out of a dead man.
Why don't you finish the job?
What good did that do you?
By what you preach, none. But what that Comanche believes, ain't got no eyes, he can't enter the spirit land. Has to wander forever between the winds. You get it, Reverend. Come on, Blankethead.
Blankethead, that is the adopted son of his then-dead brother, Jack Beatty. The roiling anger in this character of John Wayne starts very early in this film, even before the ranch is burned down.
Oh, that's right. And there's an element here of sexual desire and illicit sexual desire that he is in love with, and perhaps even it's reciprocated with his brother's wife. And this comes out just in gestures and in her and in hints, but we clearly get it that there was something between them. And so when the Indians kill her, defile her, rape her, they have acted out, you know, at some level, one of his, at least, and they kill his brother too, you know, part of one of his, you know, horrible impulse here. And that sort of, you know, projection outward onto the Indians is some of his own feelings, I think, adds to the fanaticism and the hatred that that this Indian has in some way done what he wanted to do.
And it gets worse in a hurry. John Wayne, Ethan is on the trail with Martin, with another young man, Brad, who had loved another of the sisters, his nieces, Lucy. She, as the Comanche go off with Lucy and Debbie, Lucy taken up into a gulch, presumably raped and brutally murdered by the Comanches, John Wayne comes back out to talk to his comrades on the trail.
Did you see Debbie?
No. No, but I saw Lucy, all right. She was wearing that blue dress and she
was... What you saw wasn't Lucy.
Oh, but it was, I tell you.
What you saw was a buck wearing Lucy's dress. I found Lucy back in the canyon. Wrapped her in my coat, buried her with my own hands. Thought it best to keep it from you.
Did they? What was she?
What do you want me to do? Draw you a picture? Spell it out? Don't ever ask me. Long as you live, don't ever ask me more.
John Wayne stabbing the earth with his Bowie knife. A.L. Scott, what is the icon that's laid out here? What's the root of it, and what does it give birth to in the years after?
Well, I think the icon partly draws on other work that that John Wayne had done with John Ford. This is certainly the most extreme character that he played in their collaboration. But there's always a degree of ambiguity and of contradiction, right in a way from the very the first major role that. The great entrance of John Wayne into movie stardom, which was in Stagecoach in 1939. But this is, you know, in a way of all the classic Westerns, one that points the way forward toward the kind of the more troubled, more morally ambiguous Westerns that we associate with the 60s and 70s. The ones that are often taken as, I think, a kind of a critique of the sort of the John Ford, John Wayne myth. And in a way, you see in this movie the mythology sort of critiquing itself because exactly of this element of rage and sexual desire an impulse both toward violence and toward domesticity, all conflicting and coexisting together. This archetype keeps going in American movies, you know, far beyond Westerns. You know, I think earlier you mentioned Taxi Driver. Certainly, mm-hmm. Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver, has in a way, you know, been remaking The Searchers periodically throughout his career. And it became a touchstone for that generation, the sort of the movie generation of the new Hollywood of the 1970s. People like Schrader and Scorsese and George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, who all in different ways have gone back into the complexities of this character and the story. And the thing that I think has made it such a fruitful movie is that it was at the time of a sort of a classic Western entertainment. My predecessor, Bosley Crowther, when he reviewed it for the New York Times, said it was a sort of a rip-roaring Western with lots of gunplay and Monument Valley scenes. And so it fulfilled those sort of requirements of the genre, while at the same time offering this kind of complexity, this contradiction. It's a very unsettling movie. It's a movie that I think, you know, has been celebrated over the years. A lot of people have found it very, very upsetting and distasteful, partly because of the character of its hero.
Travis is calling from Boston. Hi, Travis. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think? Do you know it? Do you see it?
I have. I love the film. And one of the things I wanted to bring up, actually, was bringing in the post-9/11 attitudes was possibly, there was a lot of Searchers-esque feelings post-9/11. And I think what we could use possibly is more of a softening, somewhat similar to Tommy Lee Jones's The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, which is another anti-hero Western, classically driven, but the fact that it, he's a lot more pensive and a lot more thought-provoking and controlled. And I wondered what Mr. Scott thought about that film and its correlation.
A.O. Scott?
Oh, I'm very glad you brought that up. I think that's a terrific movie. And if people haven't seen it, I think by now it should be available for home viewing. Directed by Tommy Lee Jones, starring Tommy Lee Jones. But I think it's a very good film to bring up because it's exactly about what a lot of Westerns are about, which is what is the boundary between vengeance and justice. And in this movie, Tommy Lee Jones' character is this rancher in Texas whose best friend is a Mexican immigrant who's shot accidentally by a border patrolman played by Barry Pepper, who's a very unsavory, unpleasant, wicked character. And Tommy Lee Jones in the last third of the movie takes the body of his friend and the killer of his friend and drags them on this long journey back to Mexico to give him a proper burial.
Right.
And you don't know, is he going to kill this guy to avenge his friends? But clearly he's working out for himself. It's not clear that he knows either what the relationship is between vengeance, between an eye for an eye, and real justice that would somehow heal or restore the wounds that's been done. And it uses all of the visual and thematic vocabulary of the classic Western to look at some of the values of the Western and critique them in a way. And it does go back, because I think that Ford's movies are rarely simplistic celebrations of the ethic of vengeance, but are about exactly this question: what is justice, and where does force give way to law, and can it? And you see a lot in a lot of his movies, in Fort Apache, in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, he's trying to get at that distinction, and think about, well, is the rule of law, does it have to be preceded by some kind of violence? Can it replace it? What is this civilization that we're always talking about, that these people in the West are trying to establish? What is it based on? What are its values? How does it survive?
And Travis asks, do we have a softening archetype here? And I'm really not sure about that. Let's, Jack Peter, I want to ask you about this sort of angry man carrying the savage defense of civilization. But let's get the context of the film, The Searchers, here in our ear as we do that. Here, they finally find Debbie. Lo and behold, she's grown up into Natalie Wood. She's the wife of a Comanche chief, Scar. They find her by a creek in the middle of more or less nowhere. And Martin, the part Indian, the adopted son of Ethan, John Wayne's brother, ends up having to defend her as Ethan attempts to kill her.
Oh, don't you remember me, Debbie?
I remember. I'm always. First I prayed to you. Come and get me. Take me home. You didn't come.
But I've come now, Debbie.
These are my people. Untamea! Go! Go, Martin, please!
Stand aside, Martin.
don't, Ethan. Ethan, no, you don't!
Stand aside.
Ethan, John Wayne, ready to kill the defiled flower of Western womanhood there, and then Martin confronting him for disowning Debbie as his kin for living with the Comanches. Let's hear that.
What do you mean you don't have any blood kin? Well, Debbie's your blood kin.
Not no more, she ain't.
Well, you can keep your will. I don't want any of your property. Besides, I ain't forgetting you was getting all set to shoot her yourself. What kind of a man are you, anyway?
She's been living with a buck. She's not that bad.
Shut your dirty mouth! I hope you die.
That'll be the day.
That'll be the day. And Jack Beatty, here, this savage defense over the top in the name of civilization.
In the name of civilization, but barely sublimated. The movie in some ways resembles the Tommy Lee Jones movie in that the character does have redemption. There is a change within the character, within the Barry Pepper character in that film, who feels genuinely contrite about what is overwhelmed with guilt and sadness. And something like that happens within Wayne, although we don't see that happening, and that may be a fault of the movie. It kind of just springs on us at the end that he picks her up in what Andrew Sarris called an awesomely avuncular gesture, holds her up above her head, and she looks terrified. And then he brings her down and holds her, and he said, "Let's go home, Debbie."
But the weirdness of us not knowing if he's going to hug her or kill her
absolutely,
in that moment.
Absolutely.
Or throw her off the cliff.
Or throw her off the cliff.
Yeah, we just don't know.
Ale Scott, is this a living Hollywood icon now then? The savage defense of civilization, the over-the-top. Is that the Taxi Driver motif? Does it still live?
Oh, I think it does, and I think it's explored, you know, in indirect and subtle ways. A movie that I thought of, and mentioned in the piece that I wrote a while back was Munich, which includes a subliminal almost reference to The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. But
Steven Spielberg's film, of course,
yes,
Liberty Valance is on playing on a television, as I recall.
Right,
you're writing in the background of the film.
Yeah, and you know, there isn't the character there played by Eric Bana is not like Ethan Edwards, but
these are Israelis set out to avenge the Munich Olympics killings, 1972,
and it's about, you know, there's the scene where Golda Meir, you know, sending them off to do this, says every civilization at some point has to negotiate its own values and principles, and that, I think, is a very Fordian problem in a way, and the way what happens in the movie where these commandos are going out to avenge the death of the Israeli athletes killed at Munich, mm-hmm, and also to prevent perhaps further acts of terrorism against Israelis, and they have a sort of a crisis of conscience because they feel like they're doing the right thing, but the means and the ends come into conflict, and it ends with Eric Bana figure in exile from his own community, much as I think the Ethan Edwards figure is. He can't go home. Somehow what he's done to defend his society has alienated him from it, made it impossible for him to rejoin it.
Makes him the eternal outlaw, almost, as you say, like John Wayne, walking off, not into the cozy home, but off into Monument Valley. Michael's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
You're right. There's very conflicting emotions that are presented from this movie. I think it's iconic in the sense, and also a perpetuation of an iconic movie like Birth of a Nation.
Racist message.
And also, it's also mythical in perpetuating the myth of John Wayne, who, though he never served in the military, killed every Japanese soldier who ever lived to help us win World War II, and became the American hero male, a myth, to me, the same as Rock Hudson was everybody's favorite leading ladies man. That being said, I do appreciate the movie for the acting, the cinematography, and also all the emotional impact that it provided. It was not your just normal odor or typical Western. But the emotional context and the time in which it was made, the mid-50s, which still, you know, was definitely a Cold War, is that we had to put everything out there for everybody to either get it or didn't. At the time, I got it as saying, well, we ran out of Japanese, we ran out of Indians, ran out of blacks. You know, we have to put something up there to show that we won't be defeated, and making the character obviously a Southerner defeated in the Civil War, which engendered a lot of rage and a lot of emotion. You know, it looks in retrospect maybe a lot worse than I saw it, and maybe not even as scary as far as wanting to kill someone who they think defiled their family. That could be a movie put out by militant Islamists.
But wanting to kill the defiler and even the defiled, even the niece herself. Michael, you've brought a lot forward from 1956 with you there. A.O. Scott, what about this fundamental question Michael raises of whether this is more critique or perpetuation, whether it's on the front of racism, whether it's this hard mythos of the American male, which do you see it on balance?
Well, I see it as very split in a way. I mean, you do learn at one point, for example, that the raids on the homesteads that the Comanches are undertaking, that led by this Scar character, are themselves acts of vengeance for cavalry raids that were killing and dispossessing Indians. So there is a context provided for this, and there is, as is true in the Western mythology, you know, going back to Fenimore Cooper, there is a sense of the Indians as tragic, as well as being, you know, the enemies who have to be fought. You certainly get that sense in what for me is the greatest of the John Ford John Wayne westerns, which is Fort Apache, which presents the most complete and contradictory picture of everything that's going on.
But here, not much sympathy for the red man, as they would have said then.
No, and I think that there's certainly I wouldn't want to deny the racist elements of the film, especially this comic or pseudo comic subplot in involving the Indian wife who attaches herself to Martin and sort of becomes a kind of camp follower.
He buys her by accident, trading trinkets, and
right.
He
discovers that he's acquired this kind of silly Indian squaw for a bride. But I think that with Ford, what's so interesting is that yes, there is a kind of a revanchist reactionary element that's very overt in these pictures, and there's also a recognition of the ugly elements of that view of the world. And I think that you know, I don't want to defend the picture or say that it's at all, you know, a liberal or politically correct or sort of ideologically palatable movie. In some ways it isn't, but that's, I think, what makes it so interesting and so alive. It gets at something in the American character and in American history that Ford does in these westerns that he made in the 50s that I think very few other movies have quite put their finger on with such power and also with such subtlety.
Jack, where do you see it on this critique versus perpetuation scale? And what about that cinematography that Michael refers to? I mean, pretty incredible. But first, that balance, how do you see it?
Well, you know, you couldn't make a realistic film about Texas then without showing what was happening. Eliza Bunton, who was Lyndon Johnson's grandmother, had to hide under the porch from Comanches, hide under the floor while they came in and wrecked her wedding present, smashed her cutlery.
LBJ's grandmother.
His grandmother. That was in 1869. And why was she alone? Because her husband had gone out to find Comanches who had stolen someone's cattle. Just precisely like this film. This was the reality. There was a race war going on between Comanche and settler along that Texas frontier. But that wasn't the only one. Coming back from the Civil War, the humiliation that our caller speaks about. That was in every Southerner's psyche, every white Southerner's psyche. And what did they do with that? They went on an orgy of violence against American freedmen, against the people who had who'd been the former slaves, who now were not protected because they weren't someone else's property, and they could be attacked with impunity and lynched and humiliated. And Texas was the site of the worst of that. George Custer, who was stationed down there, wrote someone a letter, and he said, "It's open season on Negroes. They shoot them everywhere." So the race element
No explicit
here,
hint of that here, but you say the attack on the Indians in this movie is a kind of a proxy for what was going on.
Oh, I think it's charged. This is 2 years after the Emmett Till lynching. This is showing us racism. This is showing us the humiliation, the fear of defilement, all the rape myth at the center of the Southern white hatred of the black after the war. All of it's right there.
Here's just another bit from the film where John Wayne, Ethan, and Martin, his co-searcher, return to the Jorgensen's homestead, sort of bring John Ford takes us into that cozy, jolly heart of the American frontier, but right outside is the danger.
Mom, Marty's drawers is a sight. Would it be all right if we gave him some of Brad's things?
Oh, of course, they're in Grandma's chest. Ethan, you're going to sleep in the bunkhouse.
By golly, the leather in the Sweden chest, Mama. It come for you, Ethan, last winter. Charlie McCory brought it.
Looking for that letter, Charlie McCourty.
By Yimini. Here it is. My golly, I forgot.
Excuse me. Mrs. Jorgensen, take a look at this.
Just a snip of calico.
Ever see it before? Maybe on a dress Debbie wore?
Why, yes. Yes, it was an apron. Ethan, have they found her yet?
Not yet. Not yet.
Ahab and his great white whale, John Wayne, Ethan there, and his abducted white niece. Daniel's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi there. First of all, I want to say how much I enjoy A.O. Scott's writing. But
here, here.
I kind of beg to differ here. I'm going to play the alternate part of saying that the film, I don't think, is anything more than a good film. I think it's considered truly great because there's been a large number of film critics who are often, kind of left-leaning intellectuals, but also since boyhood they have a love of Hollywood Westerns and American mythology, and they've always been a bit guilty about this. This kind of love of right-wing Westerns. So The Search is the perfect antidote, because finally there's a Western that addresses, you know, the racism and imperialism and Indian killing of the whole West myth and the expansion. Mm-hmm. And, David Thompson, the film critic, hates John Ford, and I kind of agree with him on this one, because I do think he's overrated, and I just don't think that The Searchers is the magnificent film that it really is supposed to be. It just finally says, okay, it's okay to love American Westerns, because here's one that is so ugly and is so pronounced that it truly knows the underbelly of the American myths.
Even as it kind of plays with celebrating it. Daniel, stick with us. A.O. Scott, there's compliments to you, but at the same time, Daniel is kind of echoing. We were reading Stephen Metcalf at, was it Slate, I think, and he says this is a film geek's paradise, preposterous in its plotting, spasmodic in its pacing, unfunny in its hijinks, bipolar in its politics, alternately sodden and convulsive in its acting, not to mention boring. And he says this is something that the first generation of film school filmmakers were adored. Scorsese and Schrader and Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas and that gang. You hear Daniel echoing the same kind of critique.
Well, this is, I think, one of the interesting things about this movie is how 50 years later it's still a very polarizing movie, and it polarizes film critics and it polarizes audiences. And I think that it is true as a matter of film history that it was certain film critics and filmmakers. Peter Bogdanovich would be an obvious one to add to the to the list that you just mentioned, who was a critic and who shot a documentary about Ford, which has some quite amazing sequences of Ford just humiliating poor young Peter Bogdanovich. But as far as it being, you know, liberal intellectuals having their ideological cake and eating it too, in a way, being able to love this reactionary form, I would say a few things about that. First of all, I don't think that the Western as a genre is an inherently reactionary genre. I think that the fact that the backdrop of a Western is always the conquest of the frontier and the dispossession of the Indians makes that reading an available and easy one. But I think that the Western is always more complicated and always more. Recently, my colleague Dave Kerr, who's I think one of the best critics who's ever written about Westerns, defended it on his blog, defended the Western as a genre as basically a progressive democratic genre about groups of people trying to form, you know, democratic societies in harsh circumstances. So I think they can be read that way, too. And I'm aware that there is, you know, David Thompson, Richard Schickel. There are a lot of very important critics who find John Ford very hard to take. I have to say that this movie for me it's you know, stands out from a lot of other Westerns, but not apart from them. I mean, I like Anthony Mann Westerns as well, Bud Bedeker's Westerns, other John Ford's Westerns. I think that in a way the Western has gotten a bit of a bad rap, maybe in the sort of the post-Vietnam generations, and that the work of those filmmakers who latched onto Ford and the Searchers was in a way trying to rehabilitate a genre that had fallen into unfair disrepute.
Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the debate about the Western is a lot like the debate in American literature about pale faces and redskins. That's a distinction that Philip Roth made. You know, we have our pale faces, T.S. Eliot and Henry James, and then we have our redskins, you know, Melville and Whitman and so on. This kind of and that goes on here, too. You know, I understand this. I've heard this criticism all my life about Ford. But I tell you, he makes movies about American history. The moving parts of history are right there on the horizon, whether it's about the colonial period and drums along the Mohawk, whether the World War II and they were expendable, or whether in the Cavalry trilogy after the war, and then in this movie and Liberty Valance. They're about something, you know, and you can say, well, they're trivial and they're not. But how many movies are about more than what their characters' subjective dilemmas are? How many movies are about more than boy meets girl or boy gets revenge for something that happens to girl? These movies are about the big moments in our history, the historical tableau. And you may not like the reading that they give to that tableau, but that's what they're about.
I think the highest bar in the world to be about something, but maybe.
Well, I think if I could build on that, because I think that's a very good point. And the thing about Ford's pictures that I think is so valuable is just what Jack was saying, that they're about history, not just about the past as this kind of static tableau where people wear funny costumes and speak in a different sort of diction, but they're about the process of historical change. They're about how these societies take hold and take root and how their values form and how, I mean, you see this in Fort Apache. They present, you know, the fort there is a microcosm of the society that's emerging in America after the Civil War with all of its customs and codes and traditions, and also all of its contradictions and its underbellies and its ugliness. And you have, as Jack was saying, again and again, a movie which a story which starts in one historical circumstance and moves you towards another and tries to dramatize how that change takes place, which is a very rare thing in American movies, and I think a very valuable and interesting one, and one that opens it, as as you're saying, to interpretation and to argument and to the debate that's gone on about these movies for the last 50 years and will continue to go on.
Force giving way to law, as you put it, A.O. Scott, but there's still the hero who's very ambivalent about that evolution. Daniel, thanks very much for your call. Let me get a call from Carrick, calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Carrick, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, Carrick.
How you doing, man?
Nice to hear your voice.
Listen, I want to raise, go back to the race problem, not as an external historical problem, not as something that's in the movie, but as something that's essential to the construction of white masculinity. Hmm. So if you have the savage civilized dilemma, how can I express virility as a man when those savages have much deeper virility, which is inimical to my other identity as a civilized man?
And what's the answer? Open up the six gun?
Right, exactly, but then lose my place in society as a price, so that I actually lose my civilization to establish my masculinity. And you find this over and over again. The big three for me were 70s masculine constructions, when you have Bronson, Eastwood, and mm-hmm. Stallone, all of them making their masculinity bones in their archetypal movies mm-hmm. by dominating a black man. Mm-hmm. And then the current story is almost the reciprocal of this. How can I establish my manhood, George Bush, when there's no savage to dominate? I better construct one. So wow. We create this bogeyman in Islam about a hyper-savage, and he's used barbarism and the quest of civilization in his construction to create the logic for this war.
Well, okay, Carrick, you're hot. Let me ask you then. I mean, I had the experience of meeting John Wayne way back 1972, shaking that big hand. When a white man shakes hands with John Wayne, what's he shaking hands with, Carrick?
This is not being part of the tribe. I'm not really sure what you guys go through. But a deep masculine guy who's there as fodder for this almost tragedy of establishing civilized white masculinity. It's very difficult to establish, I think. And I think this is why it's an ongoing, that's why it's archetypal. This is why it resonates. I find the movie quite beautiful, actually, because it doesn't resolve the dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott is an old friend away. Of yours, I guess, and Carrick says, virility at gun.
Yes, and it's wonderful to hear from Carrick again. And as always, as I remember, he puts it much more incisively than I can. But I think that's exactly the unresolution of the end. I mean, the fact that he's not. You know, he does what he does and what he feels he must do to establish this manhood that's almost excessive, that's almost sort of beyond anything that this civilization can take. The same thing happens in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, where the man who is treated as the hero officially is the Jimmy Stewart character, who's the sort of the fancy-pants intellectual lawyer who gets credit for the act of violence that John Wayne actually, you know, the killing of Lee Marvin, of Liberty Valance, but who knows sort of the secret, that it's actually this man who had no place in the state that was going to be established on this frontier, but whose dirty work, as it were, was necessary to get it established and to establish. I mean, in that case, the Lee Marvin is a white other, but I think standing in for all of these other others.
Carrick, let me ask you that whole dynamic of attributing the hyper virility to the red man or the black man, is that a kind of racism in itself? Are we past that, or is that still in the American mythos?
Oh, no, it's deeply in the American mythos, and I actually do think the need of the Bush administration to construct the Islamic other as a barbarous one, this constant construction about civilization versus this other, that these people want to destroy civilization itself. And the fact that worked, the fact that people believed it, the fact that people began to racialize their fear, is a sign that it's there latent in us always here. And I think it really becomes, it becomes historical, so that the West against the non-West, the modernity against the non-modernity, but also the construction, the reconstruction, the recent last 10 or 15 years redemption of white masculinity, so it's okay to do NASCAR and drive trucks again, is really parallel with the withdrawal of the welfare state, of the withdrawal of social justice legislation, the withdrawal. I mean, the people were arguing over whether to do the Voting Rights Act this week.
we're back and we're bad. Yeah. But there's the attack at the same time. Carrick, thank you so much for calling. I'm glad to get you and AO back together. Let me get one more call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Mike's on the line. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey. Well, I wanted to get back to your original thoughts on this film. Of course, what has made it so remarkable is the last 30 minutes of conversation and all the topics, which I agree with most of the callers and the points they've made. But this film just almost continues with the American psyche of the fact that we're these civilized and fair people who believe in justice, but then when our backs are against the wall, we can fight and just be as ruthless and bloody as, you know, our enemies. And you see this in the film. It comes out in a lot of other films, as you mentioned. It seems to be an ongoing theme through the years, both in reality and in film. In The Patriot, here Mel Gibson was this warm, fatherly, colonial figure, and yet there's this side of him where he's this bloodthirsty, mad killer that comes out as the movie was on.
Well,
A.L. Scott?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, please, please. We're nearly out of time, and Mike's made a good point. I'd like to hear you on it.
Well, I think that's a good example, because one thing that you know happens in movies that I think take a simpler view of vengeance is it's very often the sort of the violation of innocence or the death of a child that will justify anything. You know. Any kind of savagery or violence, and there's something that, I mean, The Patriot is a disturbing movie to me because it places that at the American Revolution. It turns the American Revolution, which we tend to think of as the great triumph of enlightenment
principles
and principles and the coming of American modernity, and makes it into a kind of a matter of a blood vendetta, as if the only reason that you could ever fight was if your blood kin was hurt, and that would justify you in any kind of, you know, scorched earth vengeance. And I think that in my reading of it, at least, the Searchers allows for more nuances to come into that than some of the later kind of, you know, Dirty Harry or Mel Gibson accounts. But that same mythos is very much at work. Certainly.
Jack Beatty, we're heading the horses home in a hurry here. Redemption by the end of this film or something else?
I think there is. Debbie lives. She's saved by her uncle. And there's no place for him. The door closes. This sociopathic person, we need him in crisis, but he's a menace to civilization when when he's inside the house.
And Debbie lives by a hair trigger there. A.O. Scott, film critic for The New York Times, it's been great spending an hour with you on The Searchers. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my great pleasure.
Jack Beatty, Whoopi-Tai-I-O, thanks for being here.
Thank you, partner.
He's right back at you. That'll be the day. No, it is. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.